The headlines: an Israeli minister confirms the secret visit of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to Saudi Arabia, calling it an amazing achievement. The European Commission warns France that news media must be able to work freely amid anger over controversial French draft law that bans publishing police images. And a new study finds that Britain's private sector economic activity shrank in November to a five-month low on fresh coronavirus restrictions. This is News. Thanks for joining us. A member of the Israeli cabinet has confirmed that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited Saudi Arabia over the weekend. Netanyahu's Education Minister Yoav Gallant told Israeli media that the premier met with the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Gallant called the meeting an amazing achievement and one of a kind between Israel and Saudi Arabia. Riyadh has denied any meeting between Netanyahu and bin Salman. Earlier, the Israeli media released aviation tracking data on a business jet which traveled from Tel Aviv to the Saudi coastal city of Neom. The report said that the jet was carrying Netanyahu as well as the Mossad chief, Yossi Cohen. The meeting is seen as the U.S. administration's last-ditch push for normalization of ties between Tel Aviv and Riyadh. Political analyst Elijah Magnier says that Israel and Saudi Arabia have had regular contacts for years.
I think it's very far from being an achievement. The relationship between Saudi Arabia and Israel is not new. The contact between the two are very regular since ages. It's coming out now, but it serves different purposes. First of all, in my opinion, I think it is an advert to Neom, mega city that is planned by Mohammed bin Salman. It's a $500 billion plan. It's also a support for Netanyahu's domestic crisis. We saw how one of his aides said, while Netanyahu is making peace, Benny Gantz, the defense minister, is playing politics because Netanyahu is accused of corruption and Benny Gantz wants to open an investigation into the corrupted deal of the submarine and naval deal that Israel did. And Netanyahu has been accused of corruption many times.
Israel has sent its first delegation to Sudan after they announced an agreement to normalize their ties last month. Sources said the members of the delegation held talks with the chairman of Sudan's Sovereign Council on Monday. It was not immediately clear who is on the delegation. For days, there have been rumors of a first Israeli visit to Khartoum on the heels of the October agreement that was brokered by the U.S. President Donald Trump. The deal followed similar U.S. brokered deals Bahrain and the UAE signed in September to normalize relations with Israel. The move drew strong criticism from the Palestinians and the rest of the Muslim world. Palestinians condemned the normalization deals as a stab in the back. The Yemeni military says it has targeted an Aramco oil distribution station in Saudi Arabia. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says the targeted facility is located in the Red Sea city of Jeddah. He said the attack was a legitimate response to what he described as Saudi crimes and aggression against Yemen. The spokesman also warned foreign companies working in Saudi Arabia to exercise caution as operations will continue. Saudi authorities have refrained from reacting to the news. Reports say that oil production in the facility has come to a halt. The European Commission has warned France that news media must be able to work freely. It comes amid growing anger over a draft law that bans publishing police images. The Commission's spokesman stressed that any legislation by EU member states must ensure the freedom of expression for both citizens and the media. Christian Wiegand said the bloc reserves itself the right to examine the final legislation to verify its conformity with its laws. Security law effectively criminalizes publication of photos and videos of French police officers while on duty. Press groups and media unions staged mass protests against the law over the weekend. They say the legislation makes France a police state by preventing documentation of abuses committed by security forces. The UK economy shrinks as a new national lockdown shuts services firms, while the news of possible COVID-19 vaccines has boosted hopes for 2021. The return of restrictions has pushed the Composite Purchasing Managers Index, which shows private sector growth, to the lowest since June. The decline is smaller than the forecast shown in polls and less severe in the Eurozone. Britain's economy is widely expected to contract in the fourth quarter, but less than it did when around the time of the first coronavirus lockdown. forecasts also say that the manufacturing sector will continue to accelerate at a healthy pace. New lockdowns have slammed the brakes on the budding recovery in the service sector, reducing Christmas shoppers by half compared to the year before. Thousands of Kashmiris are living in a constant fear of death and destruction amid continued hostility between India and Pakistan on the line of control, dividing the disputed Himalayan region. Our correspondent Shana Bhatt has traveled to a village on the Indian side of the de facto border and has filed this report.
Some 120 kilometers from Srinagar, the summer capital of Indian-administered Kashmir, lies Uri. The line of control that divides Kashmir into two parts and ruled by India and Pakistan runs through this area of Baramulla district of Indian-held Kashmir. After trekking around 10 to 15 minutes, you reach the Smurthal village, which is frequently a target of India-Pakistan animosity. Parvez Ahmed's house was completely destroyed in the recent India-Pakistan face-off, although his family was lucky enough to survive this devastating attack.
This is not new for the people who live near the LOC, but this time it was a rain of artillery. Years of my toil is wasted. I and my family of five are homeless now in this winter. The fire even burned the food stock that I had stocked up for the winter months.
Weeks have passed since the incident. Parvez is still waiting for help and relief work to begin.
We have repeatedly asked the government to build bunkers for the people living in this area. The government is not paying attention to our needs.
Government officials told Press TV that the Jammu and Kashmir administration is working on a project to construct 44 bunkers for people living along the line of control. They said that another project for building some 250 individual bunkers is underway.
Whenever we go to government officials with a request, they often turn us away. Many times they say, go and seek help from Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Whatever is being said about help and relief is a media stunt, a part of which might reach us but too late.
For decades, Kashmiris have been bearing the brunt of India-Pakistan animosity. The two countries have fought two of their three wars over Kashmir, which they rule in parts but claim in its entirety. Kashmir has lost tens of thousands of people after the armed struggle against Indian rule began in 1989. India accuses Pakistan of training and sending fighters into Indian side of Kashmir, something Pakistan denies but says it only supports the idea of free and unified Kashmir, politically and diplomatically. The question that remains is how long will Parvez and many others like Parvez wait for government's assistance? Can they survive this harsh winter without a proper shelter? And how long will it take the world to stand for the resolution of this long-pending dispute without further destruction? Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
The West and the European Union have cast doubts on the integrity of the upcoming Venezuelan parliamentary election. Caracas, however, says the ultimate decision is that of the Venezuelan people. Jesus Silva has more.
The Venezuelan Vice President Delcy Rodriguez has slammed the United States and the European Union for casting doubt on the legitimacy of the legislative elections, which are scheduled to be held in the South American country on December 6th. Washington and Brussels have accused the Venezuelan government of disregarding legal and fair conditions to hold the parliamentary vote. Rodriguez said criticisms leveled by the U.S. and the EU against the integrity of Venezuelan elections and their calls for its cancellation will have no effect on the polls.
Venezuela doesn't care if the U.S. and the European Union don't recognize our elections. They don't rule the world.
Other Venezuelan officials also agree with the vice president, stressing that the will of the Venezuelan people is what actually matters.
The only approval that Venezuela's elections need is millions of citizens casting their ballots, and that will happen.
Some opposition figures, however, side with the critical foreign stance against the Venezuelan vote.
The conditions of the upcoming elections are in favor of the ruling party. That's why the U.S. and the EU support boycotting the polls.
This is while a number of opposition figures reject the idea of boycotting the election.
Most opposition parties will participate in the upcoming electoral event on fair terms, so we condemn criticisms and a possible boycott.
Although the U.S. and the EU keep mounting pressure against Venezuela through economic sanctions and discrediting its election, Caracas is determined to stand for the nation's right to choose its authorities by the people's vote. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
Okay, I guess we're going to talk about Sudan. Muhammad Fazari, joins us from Khartoum to tell us about the latest. Mohammed, over to you. Tell us the latest that exists in terms of news coming about Israel and Sudan.
Yeah, great. We hear today that is the delegation, Israeli delegation, visit Khartoum and met with the President of Supreme Council, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and discussed many issues regarding the steps taken by Khartoum last month about how normalization, mutual ties between Khartoum and Tel Aviv. But from the government side, no comments from the Sudanese government about such a visit. And we know this visit is scheduled to be on the 15th of this November, but has been delayed for a few days, but without any confirmation from the government from Sudan or the Israel. But for sure, the meeting was took place on a high level of military side of the government. Still, the civilian side was not informed about this visit because there is a split among the Sudanese government, the civilian and the military, about how normalizing ties with Israel. As you know, that the key parties of the Sudanese government coalition, which is Forces of Freedom and Change, most party categorically rejected any kind of normalizing ties with Israel. That's why the issues of Israel delegation is always takes place in high confidentiality and in a secret way, that people, they don't have any information about what is going on between the Sudanese government and the Israeli government. But for sure, the normalization is something that is highly rejected in many Sudanese parties, whether the Islamist or the Arab nationalist parties. They are totally disagree such rapprochement or any kind of relation with Israel. This start relation between Sudan and Israel on February this year, when General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan visited Uganda and met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The visit, which provokes anger in Sudanese political parties, and which says that the Sudanese government has no mandate to discuss such normalizing relations because it is not elected government and it does not express the will of the Sudanese people. Other parties think such things should be based on legislative council or the parliament so that to be approved, because the Sudanese constitutional document stipulated very clear that any relation should be based on the mutual interest, and they think that there is no mutual interest between Sudan and Israel. And for sure, this bore in mind of the Sudanese people that the capital, Khartoum, was known for sure that the capital of three no's: no for peace, no for negotiation, and no recognition of Israel. This has become like stab of the Sudanese parties, that is a historic party, I mean Umma National Party and the Communist Party, which support the Palestinian issues and the Palestinian people, their right to live in their state. And many people think that Israel is an occupying regime and has no right to deal with the Sudanese government, particularly this traditional government, which has a very clear task and very clear mandate, which is not to involve in normalizing relations with Israel.
Thank you very much for that. Mohammed Fazari there talking to us from Khartoum. Many thanks. In its latest show of military might, Iran has unveiled a new ocean-going warship with cutting-edge weaponry and technologies on board. This comes as tensions between Tehran and Washington have risen to an all-time high, with reports indicating that the U.S. was mulling over a military strike on Iran. Tehran has warned the U.S. of a crushing response in the event of such aggression.
The naval fleet of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has recently received a new domestically built ocean-going warship capable of carrying aircraft, drones, and missile defense systems. The heavyweight multipurpose vessel, which has been designed for long sea journeys, joined the IRGC's Navy during a ceremony on Thursday. The 4,000-ton warship, which is 150 meters long and 22 meters wide, can carry drones, helicopters, and operational vessels, as well as missile, air defense, and radar systems. It is named Shahid Rudaki Warship after martyred IRGC Navy Commander Abdullah Rudaki. The vessel is equipped with three-dimensional phased array radars, surface-to-surface and surface-to-air missiles, advanced communication systems for electronic warfare, and a Khordad 3 air defense system, all of which are designed and put into operation by Iranian experts.
The main main issue for the armed forces is to be strong enough to defend the country and to retaliate any possible attack against Iran. So that is part of that. And since we have the Persian Gulf and actually the Caspian Sea and south and north of Iran, it has been very important to have a good and powerful navy.
Rear Admiral Ayreza Tangsiri, commander of Iran's IRGC Navy, said the vessel can carry out combat, logistical, and intelligence-gathering missions in the ocean aimed at establishing stable security in maritime transportation lines and providing assistance to the commercial and fishing fleets belonging to the Islamic Republic and regional countries.
Well, in recent years, Iran has made major breakthroughs when it comes to different areas in this particularly defense sector, and it has attained self-sufficiency in producing important military equipment and hardware, which run the gamut from manned and unmanned aircraft to advanced missiles, vessels, and submarines. This comes amid heightened tensions between the United States and Iran, which were already growing since Washington unilaterally withdrew from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal 2 years ago. Reports are surfacing that U.S. President Donald Trump has been contemplating attacking Iran's nuclear facilities. Now, how does such a scenario benefit the president, who is already grappling with a political crisis at home?
U.S. President Donald Trump's new acting defense secretary, Christopher Miller, said last week that Washington will be cutting the number of its deployed troops to Afghanistan and Iraq to 5,000 from 7,500 forces that are currently present there. Just days later, however, the U.S. Central Command said in a statement that two B-52 bombers were deployed to West Asia on short notice to deter what it called potential aggression and reassure U.S. partners and allies in the region. That comes after the New York Times said in a report that Trump had asked his close allies what options were available to take action against Iran's main nuclear site at Natanz. The report adds that the advisors warned the president that a military action could spark a broader conflict in the region.
There have been times that Iran and the United States have been much closer to a war between themselves. So it's not a tough situation right now. It's not the tension is high to some extent, but it's not that high that we would be worried about any possible war. But the United States know that it's not capable of attacking Iran and doing a war, because we have seen for 20 years the situation in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and the United States wasn't capable of fighting against those countries completely, and we were introduced to endless wars because of those two countries. So let alone the Iran, which is actually much more powerful and much bigger than those countries.
Some experts are now questioning how such an attack would help Donald Trump while the United States is dealing with political uncertainty over who will control the White House for the next 4 years following a contested election. Donald Trump announced the United States' withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and launched his so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran by unilaterally reimposing sanctions on the country. His stance on Iran has been repeatedly criticized internationally, including even by the closest U.S. allies. But Tehran has warned that any aggression by the U.S. against Iran, be it Trump's attempt to distract the American public in the aftermath of the November 3rd election, or an excuse to stay in power, will certainly be met with a crushing response.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the United States, approximately 36 million tons of food, between 30 to 40% of the food supply, is wasted every year. In the United Kingdom, households waste 4.5 million tons of food each year. In Australia, nearly 7.3 million tons of food is wasted. Associated with food waste are the economic costs that arise from the resources used to produce food. For example, farmers use 1.8 billion pounds of nitrogen fertilizer and 1.5 billion pounds of phosphorus fertilizer annually to grow wasted crops, whilst applying more than 750 million pounds of pesticide to protect food that often ends up wasted. According to the UN Food and Agricultural Organization, FAO, direct economic consequences of food wastage, excluding fish and seafood, run to the tune of $750 billion annually. All these depressing statistics can lead people to think individual actions would not make a difference. However, in the fight against food waste, everyone's contribution matters. So what can individuals, businesses and organizations and corporations do to stop food waste? We are prepared for you an article written by Esther Gumbi, an assistant professor in the Department of Entomology and African American Studies at the University of Illinois, under the heading, "We all have a part to play in the war against food waste." The article was published by AlJazeera.com website. Please stay with us for more of Esther Gumbi's article. On 29th of September, the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, FAO, and the UN Environment Programme observed the first ever International Day of Awareness of Food Loss and Waste. They urged everyone to take action to reduce food loss and food waste across the entire agricultural value chain. This is a timely message today in a world where food worth more than $1 trillion is lost or wasted every year. More than 800 million people are hungry, and the COVID-19 pandemic has only made the problem worse. According to the Food and Agricultural Organization, FAO, one-third of food produced for human consumption worldwide is annually lost or wasted along the chain that stretches from the farms to processing plants to marketplaces, retailers, food service operations, and our households. And there are many factors that contribute to food loss, including limitations on crop production and other resource-saving agricultural techniques, inadequate transport and storage infrastructure, changing climate and excess purchases and portions. Surprisingly, the proportion of food produced but not consumed within developing and developed nations are similar. However, the reasons for food waste in developed and developing countries are significantly different. In developing countries, food waste happens during food production and is mainly due to climate-induced crop failures and inadequate infrastructure to transport food to the market and to store it once it is produced. By contrast, in developed and industrialized countries, food is wasted mainly due to consumer buying or cooking more food than they need. In addition, according to a 2016 survey by the Harvard Food Law and Policy Clinic, many consumers throw away perfectly good food because of confusing expiry date labels. Despite most of the wastage taking place at the very end of the value chain, developed countries contribute significantly to global food waste. In the United States, approximately 36 million tons of food, between 30 to 40% of the food supply, is wasted every year. In Britain, households waste 4.5 million tons of food each year. In Australia, nearly 7.3 million tons of food is wasted. Associated with food waste are the economic costs that arise from the resources used to produce food. For example, farmers use 1.8 billion pounds of nitrogen fertilizer and 1.5 billion pounds of phosphorus fertilizer annually to grow wasted crops, whilst applying more than 750 million pounds of pesticide to protect food that often ends up wasted. According to the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, FAO, direct economic consequences of food wastage, excluding fish and seafood, run to the tune of $750 billion annually. All these depressing statistics can lead people to think that individual actions would not make a difference. However, in the fight against food wastage, everyone's contribution matters. So what can individuals, businesses and organizations and corporations do to stop food wastage? In developed countries where consumers are responsible for most of the waste, every single person can play an important role in turning the tide. Simply by not buying more food than they can eat, consumers in the developed industrialized countries can help significantly reduce food wastage in their countries. Buying locally produced food which does not face the risk of being spoiled during transport can also help. Repurposing leftover food, especially after big celebrations like Christmas, Thanksgiving, and Super Bowl, can also have a huge effect. Individual consumers can also help the fight against food wastage by sharing their concerns with restaurants they dine in or the markets and shops they buy their groceries from. If consumers start to choose establishments that make action against waste over others, more businesses will implement policies to prevent food wastage. Businesses themselves can do a lot to prevent food waste. They can encourage their customers to take leftovers home, and they can donate any excess produce to those in need. There are organizations in most developed countries helping businesses repurpose surplus food. For example, in some developed countries, feeding organizations partner with farm owners, food manufacturers, and businesses to rescue food that would otherwise go to waste and send it to food banks, food pantries, and meal programs. Fighting food wastage also makes business sense. In 2017, a study evaluating financial cost and benefit data from 700 companies in 17 countries found that for every $1 companies invested to reduce food loss and food waste, they saved $14 in operating costs. The savings that can be made by avoiding food wastage is also very high for private households. So advertising the financial benefit of taking action against food wastage too can speed up change. Meanwhile, in developing countries where most of the food goes to waste because of climate-induced failures, efforts geared towards helping farmers access resource-saving agricultural techniques and climate-smart practices to ensure all planted crops are harvested will go a long way. Investing in new technologies that expand the shelf life of fresh produce can also help reduce post-harvest losses. Campaigns to increase awareness about the issue can also pressure governments to invest more money in food waste reduction. And while consumers have a relatively smaller effect on food wastage in the developing world, individuals can still help the fight by making sure that their household is not wasting food. In short, there is something we can all do to ensure tons of food do not go to waste whilst millions of people are struggling with hunger across the world. While collective action is crucial, especially in the developed countries, individual consumers and businesses can also make a big difference simply by changing their habits and their practices.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Allah Ta'ala says, A'udhu Billahi Minash Shaitan Rajeem, وَمَنْ أَظْلَمُ مِمَّنْ مَنَعَ مَسَاجِدَ اللَّهِ أَنْ يُذْكَرَ فِيهَا إِسْمُهُ وَسَعَى فِي خَرَابِهَا. Who is it who is more unjust than the one who prevents the masajid, the masjids of Allah, for his name to be remembered in them, number one. Number two is who strives to destroy those masjids. And then he continues to say, أُولَٰئِكَ, those people, لَيْسَ لَهُمْ أَنْ يَدْخُلُوهَا إِلَّا خَائِفِينَ. They are not supposed to enter those places of worship except in a state of fear. وَلَهُمْ فِي الدُّنْيَا خِزْيٌ, and in this world, they will have humiliation. وَلَهُمْ فِي الْآخِرَةِ عَذَابٌ عَظِيمٌ. In the hereafter, they are going to have an indescribably great punishment awaiting them. Now, before I go on, I'm going to be, inshallah, just giving you a preview of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to be talking about masjids and the destruction of masjids and the spiritual significance of a masjid and how even in today's world we have elements that are trying to corrupt masjids. But there's a question that I just want to address from now, which is that, well, many of us might be thinking, I don't have a masjid that I go to. I might go to a center, for example, this center, but I don't have like a masjid, like a real masjid which has been set aside and given that legal designation, Islamic Shari'i designation, as being a masjid. So then, is this even relevant to me? So on that point, I just want to mention that what we're talking about here is primarily about masjids, but when we look at the writings of the scholars who look at these things deeply, they do talk about this idea that there's one time when you talk about a masjid which is actually a masjid. There's another time when you talk about those places of gathering and worship which have the effects of masajid. And maybe we can say that here for us living in the West, the different communities, because of the situations, not everyone is in the position to establish like a formal masjid. But as you know, in many, many cities like this one, there are many centers, alhamdulillah. And so this discussion is very much relevant to us, whether we're talking about this institution or, let's say, the Islamic schools or the other centers and establishments that have been set up for the same purposes described in this verse. So Allah, in this verse, is talking about people who prevent masjids from performing their function, from reaching their potential, and they actually strive to destroy those masajid. Now, in history, there have been different groups that have tried to do that. In particular, with relation to this verse, there are some traditions which indicate that it refers to the Masjidul Haram, the masjid attached to the Kaaba, the Masjid of the Kaaba, where the mushrikeen, they would persecute the Muslims and it would prevent them from going to the masjid and praying there. When the Prophet ﷺ would pray, they would sometimes go and mock him and call him names and throw things at him, throw garbage, throw animal skins. Other Muslims who would like to go there and worship, they would persecute them. until eventually it came to the situation where they had to do the hijrah, they had to migrate. But as you know, the verses of the Quran are not limited to just the occasion or the instance of revelation. They're things which are eternal. Then they are applicable even at our times as well. So it's very interesting that here Allah is talking about people who strive to destroy institutions or the purpose of institutions, which are set up for the sake of God. And so when we're trying to understand what's the biggest act of injustice, maybe a lot of us thought about this, that, well, it's when you go and kill these people, for example, like a group of children or a group of innocent souls or the Ahlul Bayt, which it is, and there's a reason for that. But in this verse in particular, Allah isn't talking about destroying people. He's not even talking about killing people or taking away their wealth or anything of that sort. He's talking about destroying institutions of worship, whether from the outside where you go and you destroy the building itself, you go and bomb it, for example, or from the inside, you go and you corrupt it. This is extremely important, that Allah Ta'ala has decreed in his creation that there should be special institutions which are set up for the purpose of remembering him. When you go to the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, we see that a masjid has a very special place. For example, we have traditions which, they're very beautiful. There's a tradition which says that, and the gist of it is this, it's from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The verse that we're discussing talks about the destruction of masajid. So first, I want to just give a bit of an idea of what is the role of a masjid in the life of a Muslim. And then I want to talk about the idea of both destroying it and then also giving it life. So when we go to the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, we see, you know, just a glimpse of what role a masjid is supposed to play in the life of a Muslim. One hadith, it's reported from, it's a hadith al-Qudsi, where Allah says that there are times when I determine that I would like to send my punishment down on people. Now, had it not been for three groups of people, I would have enacted my punishment on them. What are these three groups of people? Number one is the people who love each other for the sake of Allah. Okay, Allah is talking about Islamic brotherhood, Islamic sisterhood, the idea of people coming together and, you know, purely for the sake of Allah, establishing, you know, greeting each other, establishing good ties, taking care of each other's needs. That's one thing which prevents Allah's punishment. Number two, the people who seek Allah's forgiveness in the early dawn. That itself is a source of lifting God's bala and punishment. And when I'm saying these, brothers and sisters, like, these are practical points, right? We all have ourselves, we have our families, we have our homes, we have our centers, we have our communities. We want to keep these safe, right? These are things which keep them safe. Number three is the group of people who give life to the masjids. These are three groups of people which prevent the punishment of Allah from descending. Another tradition, which is also a hadith al-Qudsi, Allah says that the masajid are my houses on the earth. And the people who go to visit these masjids, they are the ones who give life to these homes. And then Allah continues to say in that hadith that طُوبَ لِمَن تَطَهَّرَ فِي بَيْتِهِ وَذَهَبَ إِلَى بَيْتِهِ. Good tidings be to the one who gets purified in his home, his or her home, and then they go to visit my home. وَزَارَنِي فِي بَيْتِهِ. تَطَهَّرَ فِي بَيْتِهِ وَزَارَنِي فِي بَيْتِهِ. They do purification at home, and they come and visit me in my home. This is what the hadith says. Now, that's something which is, you know, profound. Right? It really is something which is beautiful and profound. The idea that you can go and visit Allah in his home by going to a masjid.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عالي شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
More than half of households in the United States of America are not very confident that they can afford to put food on the table as the holidays approach, according to federal census data. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Mike Ludwig Ryder. This article is published under the heading, As a Stimulus Runs Out, 56% of U.S. households are worried about affording food. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. More than half of households in the United States of America are not very confident that they can afford to put food on the table as the holidays approach, according to federal census data. Meanwhile, what remains of federal pandemic relief programs is set to expire before the end of year. U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has so far refused to take up a $2.2 trillion economic relief package passed by Democrats months ago, even after Democrats attempt to compromise with Republicans and lower the price tag by $1.2 trillion. If U.S. Congress fails to act, an estimated 12 million workers will lose federal emergency unemployment benefits when they expire on December 26th, on top of the 4.6 million who will have exhausted their benefits before then, according to the Century Foundation. The COVID-19 pandemic has entered a terrifying phase in recent weeks, forcing some state and local governments to issue stay-at-home orders, while others refuse to impose serious mitigations despite spikes in cases and hospitalizations. The U.S. has reported an average 162,860 new cases each day over the past week, a 77% increase from the daily average 2 weeks ago, according to the COVID trackers at the New York Times. Deaths surpassed 250,000 on Thursday, November 19th. We have had 1 million cases documented over the past week. Our rate of rise is higher than it even was in the summer. We have hospitalizations going up 25% week over week, said Brett Girora, Assistant Secretary for Health and the Department of Health and Human Services, in an interview with CNN on Thursday, November 19th. Unemployment remains stubbornly high as cities and states stare down another round of lockdowns, with 2.2 million people filing new unemployment claims over the past 2 weeks, according to the Economic Policy Institute. State unemployment benefits are paid for 26 weeks, but the pandemic has gone on much longer than that, leaving millions of people dependent on the two federal unemployment programs established by the first pandemic relief package passed in March. These programs are set to expire the day after Christmas. Millions of families are sitting on the fiscal cliff. 56% of households in the United States of America are not very confident that they will be able to afford enough food in the next 4 weeks, according to federal data collected in late October. The Center for Budget and Policy Priorities estimates that, right now, up to 11 million children live in households that could not afford enough to eat over the past week. And 40% of children live in a household that is either food insecure or behind on rent. When people struggle to afford basic needs, their spending on non-essentials such as holiday gifts plummets, further slowing an already sluggish economic recovery as the pandemic takes a turn for the worst. Meanwhile, U.S. Congress remains at an impasse over a second pandemic relief bill. The White House has backed out of negotiations as U.S. President Donald Trump remains fixated on spreading disinformation and attempting to overturn the election he lost to Joe Biden. With two Republican Senate seats at risk in an upcoming runoff in Georgia, McConnell has said Congress should pass another stimulus, but Republicans are reportedly sticking to a $500 billion proposal. Democrats say much more is needed, including another round of stimulus checks and support for state and local governments struggling on the front lines of the pandemic. In a letter to McConnell this week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer implored the GOP to return to the negotiating table this week and come to a COVID-19 relief agreement to crush the virus and save American lives. Earlier this year, during negotiations with Secretary Steven Mnuchin and Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, we agreed to compromise on a relief package and lowered our request by $1.2 trillion, they wrote. Since that time, you have lowered your proposal from $1 trillion to $500 billion, despite the consensus from economists and experts that the country requires a much larger injection of aid, they added. Indeed, financial analysts say relief proposals offered by Democrats would allow for the most economic recovery. A new international analysis by the Institute for New Economic Thinking found countries such as South Korea and New Zealand that focused on lockdowns early in the pandemic rather than preserving their economies have gained control over the virus and are now seeing their economies grow, in contrast with the dire economic circumstances currently in the United States of America. Reflecting Trump's view of the pandemic, much of the GOP appears unfazed as the nation plunged toward a fiscal cliff. Promising news that a COVID-19 vaccine is on the way may be buoying hopes among Republicans that an easy fix to the pandemic is on the horizon. However, there are growing concerns that the state governments lack the resources necessary to effectively distribute a vaccine. States need at least $6 to $8 billion to distribute a vaccine, and to date, only $200 million has been allocated for vaccine preparedness, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. Chuck Schumer announced on Thursday, November 19th, that McConnell had agreed to restart negotiations with Democrats, although he offered few other details, according to reports. Democrats and Republicans must agree on a government spending package by December 11th to avoid a government shutdown. If they don't agree on pandemic relief as well, millions of their constituents will be struggling to afford food, not to mention rents, medical bills, and other expenses by the end of the year.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3rd, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq. Greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week.
What kind of government is the French government? The same government offered the most help to a bloodthirsty wolf named Saddam. Of course, we cannot say that it offered more support than other governments. It was one of the main supporters of Saddam in that war. It provided that bloodthirsty wolf with advanced planes and advanced equipment, and they were not ashamed of doing it, as they have acknowledged it. This is related to their behavior towards terrorists and the like. But you have also witnessed how they treated their people during the Saturday Yellow Vest demonstrations held last year. That is while they claim to be interested in freedom, human rights, and other such values. I believe that these are the two sides of the same coin. In other words, defending that act of cultural savagery and the criminal action taken by a cartoonist is one side of the coin, and the other is defending and helping the Munafiqeen and Saddam. These are the two sides of the same coin.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Well, such courses of action have been repeatedly adopted in European countries and in the U.S. The incidents related to insulting the Holy Quran and the Holy Prophet have frequently occurred in Western countries, in both the U.S. and European countries. But such incidents cannot damage the honor, magnificence, and greatness of the Holy Prophet of Islam in the slightest manner. It is completely clear that the enlightened personality of the Messenger of Mercy cannot be damaged with these actions. By Allah's favor, this sun shines more brightly on a daily basis. Just as the thugs in Mecca and Taif could not erase the name of the Holy Prophet of Islam, despite all the efforts that they made, these excellencies will not be able to damage the Holy Prophet either. However, one can understand a point from this incident, that these courses of action show the dark nature of the Western civilization.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.